This is the Tea on International Arbitration with Nicole Silver and Gaela Gehring Flores, where we aim to give you bite-sized information regarding international arbitration topics of interest. Today, we return with yet another special episode of the Tea, which we're actually breaking up into two episodes. So this is part one of two. So far, we have given you insight and perspective from some of the leading players in international arbitration, individuals who act as counsel, arbitrators, experts, and even funders of international arbitration. Today, we bring you yet another perspective, the party's perspective. And not just any party. Today, we bring you the perspective of the sovereign respondent in international arbitration. We bring you the legal team of the Ministry of Finance of the Czech Republic. And the tea on the Czech team is that they have now won their 13th international arbitration victory in a row. To properly introduce the Czech team, we have yet another guest for you, someone who I'm very proud to say is my colleague, Bart Wasiak, a senior associate in the London office of Arnold & Porter, who, other than being an extraordinary international arbitration attorney, has had the privilege of working with the Czech team on more than 8 cases. Bart, could you please do the honors of introducing our special guests today?
Thank you, Gaela. It's a pleasure to be here with you. And it's an honor for me to introduce the two special guests, Anna Bilanova and Jarek Kuldina. As you said, Anna and Jarek are both officials with the Ministry of Finance of the Czech Republic, which is one of the world's most experienced teams of in-house government lawyers handling investment treaty arbitrations. Anna is a deputy head of the International Arbitration and Investment Protection Unit at the Ministry of Finance, where, among other things, she's involved in the representation of the Czech Republic in investment arbitrations and participates in treaty negotiations. Anna also represents the Czech Republic in meetings of the EU institutions and international organizations, including notably both ICSID and the UNCITRAL Working Groups 2 and 3. Among her other qualifications, Anna holds a Master's of International Dispute Settlement, MITS, from the Graduate Institute in Geneva. Jarek is head of the International Arbitration and Investment Protection Unit. Like Anna, he is involved in the representation of the Czech Republic in investment arbitrations, as well as in treaty negotiations and in meetings of international organizations. Prior to joining the Ministry of Finance in 2017, Jarek worked for several years as an associate in the International Arbitration Group of White & Case in New York, where he focused on both investment treaty and commercial arbitration. Before that, he trained at leading law firms in Paris and in Prague. And among his other qualifications, Jarek holds a PhD in public international law from Charles University, as well as 2 master's degrees. Both Anna and Jarek are involved in the organization of the Investment Treaty Arbitration Conference in Prague, which is hosted annually by the Czech Ministry of Finance. The conference is notable for focusing on the perspective of respondent states and for attracting a large number of government in-house lawyers from different countries. And as you said, Gaela, I have had the pleasure of working with both Anna and Jarek for the last few years, and I'm really excited that we have this opportunity to talk to them today.
Thank you, Bart, for introducing our guests today, and thank you to Anna and Jarek for joining us on the Tea and sharing a bit of your experience with us. Let's get to the questions. Our first topic today is confidentiality in investor-state dispute settlement. And the specific question I have for you is, what, in your view, are the advantages of transparency in investor treaty arbitration? Are there any disadvantages? And if so, what is the best solution for a respondent state to adopt? Anna, I think I'm going to start with you on this question.
Okay, thank you, Nicole, and thank you to you and Gaela to invite us to participate in this podcast. It is a pleasure to me and as well as to Jarek. And I would just like to briefly note that anything I say or we say, it's not attributed to our government or the Ministry of Finance, but it's our personal opinion based on our practice and experience. So to reply, to go back to your question, I believe that there are many advantages of transparency in international arbitration. First, as you know, the ISDS in particular catches huge media attention, and we have seen it multiple times in our proceedings. And therefore, if the state is not transparent, it might seem that it is hiding something from the public, and it doesn't look good for the public relations perspective for the state. So I think if you are transparent, it brings a lot to accountability of public authorities, and it generally adds to the better public perception of international arbitration of the public. Second, as opposed to the commercial arbitration, the ISDS touches upon more subjects. It is much broader in the scope, and it concerns issues of public interests, and therefore you need to be transparent in terms of both, like the costs spent on the disputes, like in terms of our representation. We hire external counsel, so we want to be as transparent as possible about the litigation costs, as well as in case a state loses. If it has been transparent throughout the process, it is then much better to communicate the potential result. If it was the opposite, it didn't tell anything to the public, and all of a sudden it would have to face a compensation of hundreds of millions of dollars. So this is also another advantage that is there. Coming from our perspective, we try to be as transparent as possible. Of course, sometimes it is not possible to be transparent to the extent you would like, because there are other concerns, and the IAREG will be talking about it. But in my personal opinion, the public authorities should at least communicate to the media and the public the outcome of the cases, including the final arbitral awards. And in the case of pending arbitration, at least some general information about the case, arbitrators involved, the amounts at stake. And we are trying as much as possible to publish anything that is possible and involves in international arbitration on our website of the ministry. And the journalists are frequently referred to that website as well. So it actually helps us to somehow effectively reply to some of the questions we are asked by journalists. Just we are constantly referring them to our website, and it proved very, very beneficial to us.
Great. Thank you, Anna. Jörg, do you have anything to add or perhaps offer an alternate view?
Good afternoon from Prague. And I would also like to thank the organizers for inviting me. And it is a pleasure to be here with you today. I also need to state that the views expressed here are only mine and shall not be attributed to the Ministry of Finance of the Czech Republic. Well, I will take on the role of devil's advocate and discuss a bit potential difficulties associated with transparency in investment treaty arbitrations. So, you know, we got the antitrust transparency rules and the Mauritius Convention concluded in 2014. However, the latter has only 7 parties after 70 years, and Mauritius is one of them. So perhaps some points I will mention might explain why states are rather slow to adopt this convention. I believe that transparency is only one of the virtues we want to see in any investment arbitration proceedings. Equality of arms, efficiency, duration, and costs are also important elements. The ideal level of transparency should achieve balance between all these factors. And I believe that one way to achieve this balance could be applying different transparency requirements when it comes to pending and concluded cases. I believe that the negative effects of transparency come into play particularly in pending cases, where it can have negative impact on the state's defense in investment proceedings. Now, to give you a few examples, for example, the publication of briefs and exhibits during the proceedings could lead to the politicization of the process. Will the briefs be written only with the tribunal in mind, or will the general public as potential readers be also taken into account? Or will certain documents otherwise useful for the state defense not be used? Unfortunately, I see these as very realistic concerns. Another point I would like to mention is the publication of witness statements. From my experience, it is already very difficult for the state to convince witnesses who are often public officials to testify about their work because it can be quite sensitive for them. I'm pretty certain that if we would tell them that their testimonies will be public and the hearing will be live streamed, we would not have any witnesses in many cases, which could be a major blow for the state defense. In contrast, witnesses for the investor often work for the claimant, so they are clearly motivated to testify. I could also mention the costs, because investment arbitration is often criticized for the high costs. Well, publishing all the exhibits clearly increases the costs, as the documents must be redacted, there must be made GDPR compliant, and this takes a considerable time and effort. So arguably the impact on legitimacy is rather minimal by publishing all the exhibits, but the increase of costs is quite substantial. I of course agree that transparency is important. You know, the request for arbitration should be published so the third parties could potentially make the third party submissions. And the main procedural decisions should also be published. But I believe that for legitimacy, the most important element is to publish arbitral awards. Publishing the reasoning is good for improving consistency of the overall system. And the public should know the reasons, particularly when the state lost and there is an impact on state budget. The ANSETRAN transparency rules provide for a maximum level of transparency, arguably without giving necessary weight to the other considerations. Perhaps it would be also useful to have a consensus on what the minimal transparency requirements in investment arbitration should be. The state could choose in their treaty practice what suits them the best. It might achieve overall a better result than having an ambitious convention which no one ratifies.
Thank you so much, Jarek. I definitely think that a lot of people don't particularly think about the impact on costs that transparency provisions provide. It, you know, as a general matter, it certainly seems that transparency is seen as a universal good with no particular downsides whatsoever. So I think it's really important that people do realize that the more and more transparent things become, particularly when you're dealing with cases that sometimes have more than 1,000 exhibits or thousands of exhibits, complete transparency can become quite costly, particularly when paired with privacy concerns and the need to redact information from all of these exhibits. So thanks for pointing that out. I wanted to turn to another topic. I think first I'll throw it to you, Jarek, again, and then I'll ask Anna about it as well. This concerns reform in investor-state dispute settlement and also the topic of intra-EU bilateral investment treaties, or BITs. So in recent years, there's been a lot of talk about reform in investor-state dispute settlement, or ISDS, as it's commonly referred to. This talk about reform has intensified over the past couple of years, particularly with the initiation of processes to amend and reform the two major rule frameworks that govern the majority of investor-state disputes, and that's ICSID and UNCITRAL. Also, in light of some pretty radical changes in terms of bilateral investment treaties between EU member states, there's been a lot of talk about reform. So, Jarek, I wanted to ask you generally more about ISDS reform. What do you think are some of the more positive developments that you can see happening with reform in investor-state dispute settlement?
Sure. Thanks, thanks, Gala, for this question. And as an introductory remark, the ISDS reform is very important for us as the state. And I perhaps might use this occasion, as you mentioned at the beginning, our annual conference, that in fact, we made an effort to promote the discussion about these reforms. And to do that, we have hosted a seminar for state representatives led by the Secretary General of ANCITRAL, Anna Juban-Bret, and the Deputy Secretary General of ICSID, Martina Polasek, discussing both the reform processes at ANCITRAL and ICSID during our annual investment treaty conference in Prague in 2019. And the ISDS reform will be certainly featured in one way or another at our conference even this year, which we are tentatively planning for the 21st October. And due to the pandemic, it will be unfortunately held online, but we hope that perhaps next year we could meet again in Prague with everyone. Well, now back to your question about some positive impacts of the ISDS reform. I mean, we would, for example, be very happy if it could solve the concern about double heading in investment arbitration. I believe that it was less an issue when there were fewer cases, but because it didn't come up so frequently. But now it has clearly become a major issue. And to give you one example, I think when the ACMEA decision, which Anna will mention in a little bit in more detail, was issued, what we have seen in our cases is that we had three arbitrators resigning in our various pending cases where the ACMEA decision, the ACMEA objection was involved. And the Czech Republic was not the only state which has experienced resignations after the ACMEA decision. To mention just a few other examples, the GAR, for example, informed about the resignation of Gary Bourne in June 2018 from two exit cases against Spain over renewable energy reforms, or about the resignation of Jan Paulsson and Gaetan Verhulst in August 2018 from the exit cases against Hungary involving the ACMEA-based objections, or about the resignation of Lucinda Lowe in September 2018 from the exit ad hoc committee hearing Hungary's attempt to annul an award in light of ACMEA. So it's interesting to see that all these resigning arbitrators also acted as counsels in global law firms. And very likely they dropped their appointments to preserve their more lucrative counsel work. And for us, this is a good illustration of the issue of double heading. You know, on one hand, we had as a practical consequences of these resignation, the increases of length and cost of these cases. Well, on the other hand, the resigning arbitrators did not face any consequences. And we believe that this issue brings bad image to the whole ISDS system and undermines its legitimacy in the eyes of its users. And that on a more positive note, we have seen a trend of more arbitrators creating their own practices or joining chambers, which is the right direction for someone who wants to arbitrate investment cases. And of course, double heading is not an issue for commercial arbitration. Perhaps to conclude this point, the creation of the multilateral investment court would in fact eliminate the issue of double heading altogether in investment arbitration.
I wonder, Jarek, you just mentioned that, of course, double heading isn't an issue for commercial arbitration. I wonder if you could explain that point a little bit for our listeners.
Well, I think it comes kind of to the nature of these both cases, that commercial arbitration is like only, you know, usually it's between two private parties about, let's say, like their private contract. It's kind of you can say like one-time thing. There's not like a particular like public interest involved, and usually there's not really like an overlap to like a number of other cases. You know, in investment arbitration, you can have multiple arbitration under the same treaty. So in a way, the one decision can have impact on other cases, even if you don't have like a precedent like the same as you have in the for example U.S. Domestic court proceedings. There is clearly impact on other cases. So what's problematic is that when you have people who in one case sit like, you know, they take, you know, as we you use this term of double hatting, right? But what it really means is that in one case they take their arbitrator hat But in other case, they take their counselor hat. And if they are deciding in one case something in a way that it benefits them when they change their hats to their counselor hat. And that relates back to my point when I mentioned ACMIA, because, right, why did they resign after the ACMIA decision, which was in March 2018, is that in the cases where they sat as arbitrators, so they had their arbitrator hat, they did not want to give like their final view on this question, because if their firm has other cases and where there are counsels, that would make it difficult, especially, for example, if as arbitrator, you would say like you would refuse the ACMIA objection, and right, in another case, as a counsel, you would defend the state and you would be making the ACMIA objection. So that's kind of how we understood why we have seen this wave of resignations.
Yeah, thanks, Jarek. I wanted to point out that we actually had an episode with Zachary Douglas not too long ago, where he spoke a lot about the issue of double hatting and the particular challenge that it presents in investor-state dispute, particularly when you have counsel in one case who might also sit as an arbitrator in another case, and that counsel wants to or needs to make sure that the precedent, even though technically there's no precedent in investor-state dispute settlement, but if an award comes out in a particular way, the way that the counsel wants it to come out for his or her client, that certainly can serve as an influence on the case where they want to use that precedent. And that's basically less likely to happen in commercial arbitrations, because in commercial arbitrations, it's not as likely that one commercial arbitration award would be used as precedent in another commercial arbitration matter. But, and you definitely mentioned ACMIA quite a few times, and I thought I would give Anna now the opportunity to talk about the other side of this question, which is reform in ISDS in a different way. And that is a huge change that we've seen with respect to investment treaties between EU member states, which, you know, usually people refer to as intra-EU bits. Now, a lot has been happening with respect to intra-EU bits in the past few years, and a lot of what's happening involves the ACMIA decision and something more recent. And I thought, Anna, you could give us your thoughts on intra-EU bits and their recent termination by EU member states.
Yes, thank you. I was involved in that process, so I can tell you about it because it really touches to the core of our work right now. Basically, for the Czech Republic, the ACMIA decision meant that we succeeded in our efforts to terminate those treaties. And the Court of Justice proved us right, because we were one of the countries that started with the ACMIA objection before. We raised it before international investment tribunals already back in 2006. So since then, we were unsuccessful with that objection that relied on the argument that all the BIT treaties concluded between two member states, mostly during the 90s, were superseded by the EU law and by virtue of Article 30, Paragraph 3 and 59 of Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, but no investment arbitral tribunal have so far agreed with that position. But since there was still kind of a discussion among the member states, because we are all parties in the same internal market and we are parties to the EU, we have rules that apply to cross-border investments, we were trying to solve that process, and the EU Commission was also seeing that problem coming, and it started even infringement proceedings against five member states to force them to terminate those treaties. And eventually, the Court of Justice came with the famous ACMIA decision, in which it ruled that the dispute resolution provision contained in the BITs and referring to investment arbitration is contrary to the EU law. And obviously, the states, member states, had to react to that judgment, because it basically means when the Court of Justice says that some legal provisions are contrary to the EU law, you need to take action and remove those incompatibilities from your legal order. And we started working on that internally, and EU Commission was facilitating the whole process. And I don't want to delve into detail because it took us 2 years to find some conclusion. But in May last year, the government of 23 member states signed the termination agreement in which we agreed to terminate our bilateral investment treaties, including the sunset clauses provision contained in those treaties. And that means that the investments that were remained before the those treaties were terminated will not have any additional protection after termination of those treaties. So far, 10 member states already ratified the agreement. We are in the process of finalizing the ratification process. And currently, this is to reply to your other aspect of the question. Currently, we are also thinking about how to cure the situation of potential lack of legal protection for the cross-border EU investors. The EU Commission is currently working on legislative proposals. In summer last year, it even launched a public consultation procedure asking the public questions about if they feel that the investors are protected or not, what should be done. And the options that were presented by the Commission that the Commission is working right now is to provide investors with new rules and more to clarify the rules for investment. And even we expect that there might be some new procedures introduced for investors, even in the form of the EU Investment Court. But we will all see, the Commission is working hard, and we hope that they will propose a new legislative proposal in May or June this year. And from there, the member states will take it on and work on those proposals in the council. So we will have a lot of work in the coming months. I think that it is good that EU Commission and member states are trying hard to somehow respond to the concerns that were expressed by many stakeholders, big market players, and that it actually is taking care of some of those concerns. And we hope that there will be some solution for those that are still not satisfied with regulation.
Thank you, Anna. This is quite a live issue, the ACMIA decision and the EU agreement to terminate intra-EU bits. It is coursing through, particularly in the United States, and I don't know, I haven't been following the courts in other countries, but certainly in the courts of the United States, there are now plenty of investors that are attempting to enforce awards dealing with intra-EU bits, and it's quite a policy conundrum for a lot of European Union states. They're stuck between the EU telling them that essentially complying with such awards is illegal under EU law, and US courts telling them that they need to pay these awards. It's quite a pickle. So, maybe we could have you back in a few months or a year and to discuss more about intra-EU bits, since this is something that is of quite a lot of interest to our listeners, for sure.
So that concludes part one of our two-part series with Anna and Jurek. We thank you so much for such an enlightening discussion today and for sharing your views with us. I'd like to remind our listeners to tune in next week for part two of this two-part series. And as always, we thank you to the DC Bar. To check out more of what the DC Bar committees have to offer, please visit dcbar.org/communities. You've been listening to The Tea on International Arbitration.